Chapter 20, A Tight Squeeze. Returning to Dublin, I was confronted with the problem of disposing of the German crew. Under confinement, they were becoming intractable. They had everything they could wish for apart from unlimited freedom, and lived in comfortable houses where there was an abundance of food, money, adulation, and clothing. Dreams of securing high commissions in the Irish Army were long since dissipated, for the simple reason that there was no Irish Army. It was then that I conceived the idea of inaugurating an Irish mercantile marine to render us independent of foreign shipping. Liam Mellows gave me for my own personal use the £1,000 I had obtained for the Frieda. I therefore paid the sum over as deposit in the purchase of the SS City of Dortmund, the vessel I selected as pioneer of the Irish Merchant Navy. Borrowing the remainder of the money, I got the venture underway and set the vessel into a legitimate trade between the continent and Ireland. On the first trip out, I sent back half the German crew to Hamburg, but not without some difficulty, for the Dortmund called at Swansea en route to load 1,000 tons of coal for Rotterdam. On subsequent trips, the vessel brought back to Ireland the remnants of Casement's so-called Irish Brigade. They had perforce to remain in Germany after the armistice, and it was only in the unorthodox manner made possible through my steamship line that their return could be effected. The city of Dortmund had a stormy career. She was repeatedly put under arrest. On one occasion in Belfast, an armed guard of Ulster Special Police raided her fore and aft, confiscating the flags and sending the vessel to sea minus the cargo which, at considerable loss of time and expense, she had called for. In September 1922, while steaming up the River Lee, loaded with a general cargo for Cork, the unfortunate vessel came between the opposing columns of Free State and Irish Republican armies. She was flying my house flag, a striking device in the national colours, beside the tricolour on the flagstaff aft. With true Irish inconsistency, both forces opened fire on the one and only ship operating as an Irish vessel. The captain was obliged to lie flat on his belly on the bridge and, from that undignified position, conduct the ship to her moorings in Passage West. In the encounter, her smokestack and superstructure were chipped and bullet-ridden. The Free State forces seized the ship, and, fully laden with Cork cargo, she was sent round to Dublin for examination for contraband. None was found, and after many abortive attempts to claim the vessel as belonging to the pre-treaty group, the effort was abandoned. Acting on my instructions and armed with power of attorney, my agent in Dublin sold the vessel. Strategically, it deprived the Free State forces of a suitable transport much needed at the time to move troops around the coast. That was the sad and sudden climax of my attempt to start an Irish mercantile marine. It was the first and last effort made in Ireland to perform the hopeless task. For although the country is an island geographically situated in the direct line of communication between the outer world and Northern Europe, we have developed no Argonauts. It is inexplicable. Much smaller countries, but with a tithe of our sea advantages, have had colonies all over the globe, Denmark, Holland, and Belgium, for instance. The subject is a sore one with me and has done a great deal to alienate my sympathy from our repeated wails for independence. Although the Frieda was put into a peaceful vocation transporting stores to His Majesty's ships lying in Queenstown, she forsook the prosaic business to perform one more good deed. Information was received at Republican headquarters in Cork that the naval supply ship Upnor was to transport a cargo of munitions from the naval base at Harbolin to Portsmouth. A delegation of the IRA proceeded to the home of the ancient mariner to whom I sold the tugboat and asked him to show just reason why he should not proceed to sea in the Frieda and, at an opportune moment, waylay His Majesty's storeship. The retired captain at first gave many reasons for not complying with the request, but finally he gave in. It is now past history. The Frieda overhauled the Upnor off the coast of Cork. At the points of several guns, the storeship captain was ordered into Ballycotton Harbour, where the entire load was confiscated. The fact that I was in Germany at the time prevented my pulling off this exploit myself. It was afterwards rumoured that the British government closed one, probably both, eyes to this coup. The Irish were fighting a civil war. They required plenty of guns for the purpose. Well, why not let them have some? The comparative ease with which the capture was made, backed by the leakage of information, pointed to a plan or plot into which we readily fell. We got obsolete guns and no ammunition at all. On my way through London in 1922, en route for Germany to secure a shipment of arms, I was called upon to carry out a foolhardy scheme that might have written fini to my career as a gunrunner. An Irish commandant from Dublin informed me that on board an American vessel lying in Tilbury were 6 Thompson machine guns and a couple of dozen Colt 45 automatics with ammunition. The Thompson gun uses the same ammunition. I asked why these had not been put ashore in Cove, knowing this line of steamers always called there. The boys in Cork didn't turn up in time, so the Yanks had to bring them here. I understood perfectly. The seamen should have advertised their arrival in the press, then perhaps a reporter might have come to see them. My own disappointments with the boys were too recent to forget. I suppose you know I've got a shipload of arms in Germany to bring over, I countered. Maybe the boys will leave me in the lurch here, as they did the Americans in Cork. Well, you're our only hope, the commandant pleaded. You know the run of the docks and shipping. Besides, the boat sails the day after tomorrow, and we must get the stuff off tomorrow night, or lose it. I agreed to do my share. I would go down in the morning and inspect the scene of operations, get in touch with our Confederates on board the ship, and at night we would smuggle the guns ashore. A presumably ardent Republican was to drive down from London with an automobile to transport the goods and passengers back to the city. He would wait at a convenient spot not far from the dock entrance in Tilbury. With an Anglo-Irish youth from the Midlands, who confessed this would be his first glimpse of a ship, I pessimistically took the train for Tilbury docks. On arrival, I located the ship and went on board. I outlined the plan of campaign to our American friends. There were 4 of them, myself and Larry, the Midlander, making 6 in all to do the job. That would mean a machine gun apiece plus a couple of 45s and ammunition, an awful load for such a small group. Plainly, I saw myself back again, in confinement with nothing to worry me but plans of escape. I told the seamen that at 10 p.m. an automobile would be waiting in the village. At 9:30, we'd leave the ship. Do your best to get some trusted members of the crew to help out. This lot will overload us, I implored them. One man caught will mean imprisonment for the lot of us. Going ashore, I rejoined Larry, who was waiting outside the gates, and we settled down to wait for night and darkness. The commandant had made a rendezvous where he and the car driver should meet me before I went on board to help get the stuff ashore. At the appointed time, we retired to the arranged place, but there was no sign of the car. We adjourned to a public house to wait and rest after the day's patrolling of the environs of Tilbury. At about 10 o'clock, a young Irishman who controlled affairs in London strolled into the public house. "Sorry to keep you waiting. That said he couldn't find the way, and his car broke down as well. So a crowd of us have come down by rail." "All right," I said. "We'll be moving. Those fellows on the ship will have given the game up. We'd better hurry if anything's going to be done." Outside, I saw the Irish representative from Dublin talking excitedly with a group of women. I explained the situation crisply and told him and his gang to wait. The young Irish lad commanding in London, Larry, and myself sauntered through the narrow wicket that leads to the dock, all trying to look like seamen or passengers returning on board ship. If I remember aright, the wicket at the entrance to Tilbury Docks is approached by a stairway, and you must practically squeeze past the policeman going in or out. At that time, the authorities in all British ports were on the lookout for Sinn Féiners, so I requested my confrères to keep quiet and let me do all the talking. I could adopt an American accent, pro tem, to answer curtly the few questions usually asked. I was well-dressed and could pass muster for the skipper or chief officer of a mailboat. At least, so I thought. We negotiated the entrance beautifully. I bade the officers, "Good night, guess we'll have rain, have a seagar," all in one breath, and passed on. This little stroke of luck in getting by so gracefully buoyed us up considerably. We felt as if everything would be all right after that. Going on board, we met the anxious Americans in the engineer's room. "Come on, boys, let's get out of here," and asked, "Any volunteers to help?" "Sure, we got two guys out of the fire room. They'll do the job and do it well." I was delighted. With this crowd, the arsenal would be well concealed. Only the number of men going ashore might look suspicious. I filled my pockets with 6 Colt automatics and slung 2 belts of ammunition around my waist. The other lads strapped the Thompsons to their legs and concealed the large round magazines under their shirts, increasing the size of their corporations somewhat, but not really noticeably. When all was in readiness, we left the ship and sauntered down the docks in pairs, testing as we walked the security of our embarrassing cargo. With the London Irish commander, I went ahead of the group to engage the friendly cop in conversation, the while the small army passed through the wicket. The American lads were to salute and say, "Good night, chief," as they passed. This would establish my social rating and lift suspicion off the boys. At the gate was the friendly policeman. "Guess I'll take a look at London again before we sail," I remarked. "Mighty interesting city." "It is, sir. Is this your first time here?" "No," I replied, "but it is always new to me. So much to be seen in London." I knew every Cockney loved the smoke, and flattering his city is as good as flattering his wife and kiddies. Meanwhile, the troops were passing by in single file. "Good night, chief. Good night, sir." They greeted me with a nonchalant gesture of salute of the American seaman. "Good night, boys," I returned. "Have a good time, but be ready to turn to in the morning at 6. We sail in the afternoon." I then bade my friend the policeman, "Good night, see you later," and I moved off. I could have wept for joy to be relieved from the tension of watching the boys pass, exposed as they were to the penetrating glare of the electric arc lamps shining on the exit. In a piece of waste ground on the outskirts of the village, the guns were transferred from the Yanks to the others waiting, and the relieved seamen went off for a stroll and a drink before going back on board. I asked them to give us time to be well on our way back to London before entering the dock to avert suspicion of such an early return. Elated, we wended our way to the station to take the train back to Charing Cross. On the platform, the Dublin commandant and the girls broke into excited talk. They were nervous, and their pronounced Irish accent was a dangerous symphony, or rather discord, at that time of night in an isolated spot like Tilbury. "Shut up," I barked. "Do you want to wreck everything with useless talk?" They were not pleased, but they went dumb from then until we reached the Strand. Outside Charing Cross, we divided into 2 groups and boarded 2 taxis giving the same address. This was situated in a quiet section of Islington. We drove through the now quiet streets of London and in due time were soon close to our destination. My friends were talking in a subdued voice, but I kept my eye on the driver sitting on the seat directly in front of me. He had left the sliding window open, and to avoid suspicion, I didn't request it to be shut. The other car was leading and was leaving us well behind. Forgetting my Yankee or even well-bred accent, I commanded the driver to speed her up a bit. He accelerated a little, but gradually eased back to the same non-committal speed. "Got no petrol," I snapped. "What's the worry, Governor? Funny I makes it this time of night." "Step on it," I shouted. "I got an appointment." We were now in a deserted street in North London, well past the Angel. The street was lined with houses with little gardens in front. Away at the far end, I saw a policeman reading his notebook under the light of the electric street lamp. I had a loaded .45 in my hand, for I was suspicious of the driver. My intuition was correct. I saw him head the car over towards the wrong side of the street to where the officer was standing. Jamming the barrel of the Colt against the back of the driver's neck, I muttered. Get back on the proper side and step on it. There's enough lead behind you to turn your carcass into a pewter monument. He threw a quick, scared look half around, and I poked the gold ring of the muzzle against his cheek. He shot back to the correct side of the street, passing smartly by the policeman who scarcely realized our passing. Coming within a moderate distance of our destination, we stopped the cab and got out. I gave the driver £2, saying, "Look here, we're only Irishmen doing our bit for the old land, just the same as you would for Mother England. When you leave here, step on it and forget this episode. I have the number of your car, and I got your name," pointing to the photo in the taxi. "Your life won't be worth a cent if you squeal. Now beat it." "Gor blimey, governor," he retorted, grinning. "I thought you was a crowd like Peter the painter's gang. My wife's half Irish, so she is. Why didn't you tell me at the beginning?" He drove off, and we moved quickly towards the house of our friend. We dumped all the cannon and ammunition. The following day, I caught the boat train from Victoria bound for Germany to dabble again with firearms. An exciting day.